welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. And once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, my buddy, my pal, part of the special Alexis on Fire week, Jordan Ratbeard Hastings from, as I said, Alexis on Fire, from Billy Talent, from Jersey, and from the legendary Hood Rat. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me, and we can communicate that way. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for the show. It is very much appreciated. And you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damian. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Subscribe to this podcast and rate it on your platform of choice. Or you can do what my friends at Cream Magazine have done and sponsored this podcast. That is right. Cream Magazine is back. One of the world's greatest music publications ever has returned, and it lives up to its legacy. This, of course, is the magazine that legendarily had Lester Bangs, I think, have the first published use of the word punk rock, or punk, certainly, way back when, in reference to fast, aggressive teenage rock and roll. And this is something that I have relied on for years for reference and research and just my own personal interest in finding old back issues and trading and acquiring them. And well, I no longer have to, because with the new Cream, they have brought back an archive of all the old issues of Cream. And I've been poring over that thing over on the website. The website, of course, is cream.com, and you can head over there and subscribe to this thing. And if you're a fan of Grand Royal Magazine and Ego Trip and all the music magazines we talk about on this show, I think this might be something for you. There are some fantastic articles about all sorts of stuff that we care about, like everything from Metal Zone pedals to bands that we talk about on this show. To Martine from Crudos wrote an article for this thing. Come on. What are you waiting for? Cream.com. And they like this podcast. Like, what a... This, it couldn't be more perfect. Actually, it could be more perfect, because this is also a family affair. Because my wife, Lauren, her uncle, Andrew Weiner, rest in peace, used to be an editor of Cream over in the UK during its initial run. So there you go. Perfect partnership we've got here over on Turned Out of Punk. So once again, check out cream.com and grab a subscription for yourself or a music lover in your... in your life. I play in a band. We're called Fucked Up. You can find out more information about us and our new record over on our website, fuckedup.cc. We have a new record called One Day out on Merge. I'm stoked about it. I really hope you enjoy it. People have said some nice things to me about it, and I thank them for that. So if you've enjoyed it, I appreciate you too. Maybe if you haven't checked it out, maybe you'll enjoy it as well. Who knows? Check out fuckedup.cc for more about that and some shows we have coming up, including tours with like Big Cheese and Restraining Order. And we're going out with some great bands. This is going to be a fun year of touring and playing some shows. So come on, and say hi. Come on, and say hey. We're working on maybe doing some live podcast dates. I shouldn't say that. I have no idea if we're working on that. When I say we, I mean Tristan and I. So who knows? All right. On to today's show. As I said off the top, today on the show is my friend Jordan Hastings from the band Alexis on Fire, from Billy Talent, from Jersey, from Outspan, from Hood Rat, someone who has been in a variety of bands. And this is a really fun conversation I've wanted to have for a while, because Burlington, Ontario is some would describe it as a suburb of Toronto. It's a smaller town in the Southern Ontario region that has produced some of the most important, there, better pronunciation there, better enunciation there, punk to ever come out of this of this region of the country, of this country, period. This goes back to Ceramic Hello, and it goes all the way to bands that we talk about on this episode. And yeah, that's it. I'm not going to blather on anymore. As I said, this is a part of a, I guess, two episode week. Originally, there was a plan to do like a Alexa on Fire month, and I was going to have all these episodes, but two of them didn't get recorded, and I ended up putting out the one with Steel way back when. Check out Chris Steel on the show. Check out George's episodes on the show. Check out Dallas's old episodes on the show. And I have held on to these for far too long, but it gives me a chance to tell you, if you have not checked out the last Alexa on Fire record, Otherness, what are you waiting for? This thing is a fantastic album. I know it has sold extremely well, and people have listened to it that are fans of this band. But if you weren't a fan of this band, give this record a chance, because I think this is a, it still sounds like Alexa on Fire, but what they're doing is different. And yeah, I really enjoyed this record. The part two of this week will be with Wade McNeil, and that'll be coming out later on in a few days. But yeah, I'm excited for you to check this out. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Jordan Hastings on Turned Out a Punk. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great to be here, my man. Good to see you.
Well, as I was just literally telling you off air, there is a lot of questions I've wanted to ask you for a very long time. And though we've known each other for a very long time, it's never appropriate to punish someone backstage at a show like I can here.
You know? Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I hear you. I mean, I'm always up for, I'm always up for chatting, but this is the perfect environment for it, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to get to all these burning questions, but first I got to start off the way they all start off, which is, Jordan, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Yeah, I do actually. High school, it would have been like, grade school. Actually, I started going to local shows in and around Burlington when I was, 12 years old. So grade 7 or something. And there was obviously a couple of punk bands, that were around the Burlington, Ontario area. I still talk to some of these guys, the band Trunk.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They were like,
so that at the time they ended up being more of a skate punk band, but when I first found them, they were more of like, they were like at Sex Pistols, kind of that kind of sound. It was that's kind of what drew me to them, was that kind of thing. And I used to go see them at these weird little shitty shows in the basement of the Ukrainian church here in Burlington called St. Mary's Hall. So I would have been like 12. I had to ask my mom to go, and she was like, you can only go if so-and-so's older sister is going to be there. So I had to go like get a chaperone and shit. So that was kind of my introduction into the kind of scene and the punk rock kind of stuff. And it wasn't just punk too. There was a lot of like, kind of like alternative bands in and around that era too. Like I remember seeing, who played that Trunk show? Old Gorp, I think, played it.
Yeah.
It was like a cool kind of weird finger picking kind of rock proggy band, which I still listen to them. They're great. And my dad actually was really into the Pistols too when I was growing up. So that was kind of how I found that. And then obviously prior to going to local shows, I was into I was in my grunge phase prior to that. So, I would say 12 years old is when I kind of discovered the punk rock kind of scene. And I was always a bit of a misfit myself and growing up, and still am. So that was kind of an open community of other misfits that could get together and that kind of feel some normalcy in and around the Burlington 905 area. So I found my people, so to speak.
Was your dad in any other punk stuff or just the Pistols?
No, just the Pistols. That was it. He was a rock guy. Yeah. My parents were, they're rock. Well, my mom's really into, 80s retro, that kind of shit. But so was my dad. My dad has a bunch of Blondie records that I've since stolen from him. So there's some punk and Blondie's punk. So yeah, yep, he was into a lot of that stuff, but he was also into he got me into the Doors and Zeppelin and shit like that. Like that was kind of his kind of stuff too. So he loved all that kind of stuff. Rush, he loved all that kind of stuff.
I think it's kind of unknown, but Burlington is always been the alternative music hotspot
in Southern Ontario, going back to like, you know, like Spoon and, you know, what was the Ceramic Hello? And there's like this whole like kind of like synth scene that starts in Burlington in the early or like early 80s, late 70s, right? Like,
yeah, there was. There was like even like the band, what's that band? The Kings, Switching the Glide.
Yeah.
They're from Burlington. And like you said, the Spoons, the band Crowbar, Oh, What a Feeling, What a Rush, like the original Crowbar.
Yeah.
I recorded at their drummer's spot when I was probably 14 or 13 or something like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So there's always been like a lot of, there's always been like a melting pot of creativity and music around here for sure. There's something in the water. I know a lot of guys that I met in high school, that are still playing music to this day. Like they started out just playing local, you know, local punk shows that either we put on or like other people in the scene put on. The Grade guys used to put on a lot of shows and the Jersey guys used to put on a lot of shows and my friends put on a lot of shows. So there's a special kind of punk rock DIY thing that was happening here.
Well, I think even going, right up to your era, like you mentioned, you know, Grade in Jersey, but Rainbow Butt Monkeys, Corp, you know, Trunk, you know, all these bands were bigger Southern Ontario bands on the circuit. Like it was, you know, and I'm in downtown Toronto, but to me, Burlington always had like kind of the hotter scene at that in the 90s and into the early 2000s.
It's weird because you're not wrong. Like it kind of did. And why would it? Like it didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But there was a few venues that stayed in business for years. And there was, you know, there was shows constantly. Every weekend there was a show somewhere in Burlington or like on the outskirts, sometimes Oakville. Or like, you know, a big thing would be for me when I was around that 12, 13 age was me and my friends would get a hitch a ride with some of our friends, older brothers or sisters to go see bands at X Club in Hamilton, which is like a punk rock kind of club back then early to mid 90s that we'd go check out. So yeah, there was a thriving kind of scene of all kinds of music, a lot of punk rock. There was a lot of kind of like grungy alternative. There was a lot of, there was like a lot of it. There was industrial bands coming up around here. It was nuts, man. It was a really fun time to be a part of it.
When you probably played this show, because I think it was like an Outspan Jersey show, but there was Bane played up here the first time they played Burlington, right?
I believe you're right. Yeah.
It's like hundreds of people there. I remember I wasn't in town, but I remember people going out to that show being like, you're not going to believe it. Like there's way more kids in Burlington than there are in Toronto shows.
Yeah, man. It was nuts. We had Taken came at one point. And played, where the hell did they play? Did they play in Oakville maybe? It was nuts, man. Super cool.
You mentioned recording at 14. Is Hood Rat your first band or did you do bands before that?
No, I started in like a band, a high school, my very first high school band when I was about 12, 13 was, it was before high school. I was in a band in grade school. It was called Gruel. And it was like, we used to cover like, everything from like, cause we were into a lot of the shit like Trunk and Science Spheric and Gorp, but then we were also young enough still to be into like, you know, Offspring and Green Day and shit like that. So we used to do it. This is kind of just before I kind of really found punk rock, but we used to do like, we do just cover shit. The stuff we wrote was terrible, but we used to cover stuff and we didn't really play any shows, but we just jammed in our buddies' parents' basement and stuff. Actually, the drum kit that was in his basement was the drummer from Science Spheric's drum kit, Matt Durant. And I was a huge fan because my bass player's older brother was friends with Matt. So he had his drum kit there. I didn't have a drum kit at the time. So I used to bash around on that thing.
So Science Spheric's Burlington too?
They're Hamilton.
Hamilton, that's what I thought. Yeah, it's Sonic Onion, right? More?
Yeah.
It's funny too, Trunk is a band that like I go back to and I still listen to Trunk. Like I love those songs.
There's some good shit, man. Yeah. I still talk to the singer frequently. He's funny. He just sent me a text the other day. He's like, I guess like some insights showed up on his Instagram and it's like, shows you who you most, interact with, like whatever. And he's like, and it was me. And he's like, I guess I'm kind of stalking you now with the demise of the tape, how the times have changed.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I look back on those Raw Energy bands and I used to punish the shit out of those dudes. Like to me, that was the apex, you know, like getting signed to Raw Energy was like That's the dream.
It was, man. Yeah. I remember when my, my pal Adam Michael, who's still one of my best pals, his band, their name completely escapes me right now, but they ended up signing to, they're like a ska punk kind of band. As
Out of Hand?
A lot of those.
Was it?
No.
I'm trying to remember who else was on the label.
No Connection, they were called.
Oh, No Connection. Okay.
They were called No Connection. I just remembered it. Yeah. So they got signed to Raw Energy. I was like, what's that like, man? He's like, because we were in a band prior to that band. He's like, ah, nothing changes, man. Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's amazing how when you're younger, everything seems bigger, including other musicians' careers.
Yes.
Like, wow, they've got to be huge. They opened for Pennywise. They got to be making millions of dollars. Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So where would you guys play? What was your first live show?
My very first live show would have been not with that band, but the next band, like the actual grade 9 in high school, recorded our first tape at a place called the Jam Zone here in Burlington. It was a band called Ballistic. And we were, where did we play? The first show would have been probably the Yellow Submarine, I believe, which was a club here in Burlington. It was a punk rock club. It was in the basement of a Chinese restaurant here in town. And they would serve underage kids. They used to give me a pitcher of beer and I would hide under the tables that they'd move aside and we'd just sit there and drink out of the fucking table. And then play the show, get picked up by our parents and then go home. And that was, you know, it was a big deal. Obviously that club didn't last very long, but,
it's not a very long looking business model.
No, they were around for a couple of years though. Like the grade 9 and 10 for me was going to that place. There was a lot of the people that like Trunk would have played there. Dayglo Abortions played there. Hood Rat played there a bunch of times. They surprisingly got a lot of pretty shows. Decent punk bands coming through there. Yeah, it was awesome, man, while it lasted.
Not a lot of straight edge shows, I imagine, though. It's kind of a different
market. Not there. Yeah. Not there. No. That came a bit later.
Yeah. So did you guys play out apart from that, or is that the one and only show you guys did?
Ballistic would have played that. We would have there's another place called Vic's Place. There was another venue called Vic's Place that I had known of prior to that, because I went and saw Shallow North Dakota there when I was still in like grade 7 or 8. Again, a friend's older sister took me. And then when I hit high school, we did Yellow Sub, we did Vic's Place. And then there was the gazebo at Spencer Smith Park that used to have free shows every Friday night. It was called Friday Night Live, I'm pretty sure. And they would just set up local bands in the gazebo. There would be like 4 or 5 on any given Friday. And we would just play those. There would be hundreds of people would make it down for those. It was pretty cool that the city did that, because I know it gave me a like good head start into the whole thing. We did shit like that. That band didn't really venture outside of Burlington too much. And then the band I was in after that was a ska punk band when I would have been about 14 at this point, maybe 15. Skaliska, and that Skaliska? Was like a yeah. That one was that's a peach. That one. It was like an abbreviation of ska is like ska.
That's awesome.
That lasted. Yeah, it was, that was something. That band lasted for about just under a year, I think. And we would have played like, you know, your Oakville YMCAs, your Burlington YMCAs, the Friday Night Live thing. Yeah, all in and around Burlington. I'm trying to think if we ever made it to Hamilton. I don't recall if we did, but yeah.
Are these all separate scenes? Like like the ska stuff that's kind of beginning to form around that time, would that bleed over and be playing with like Grade and Trunk and Rainbow Butt Monkeys, or is it different?
It would have. There, like a lot of it didn't. There was a little bit of the separation between the punk rock kids and like the kind of, you know, your Rainbow Butt Monkeys kind of people. They were a little bit of a different scene. We would do a lot of DIY shit. Like I remember what my guitar player for Skaliska, he is in another band called Green Eggs and Ham. He's no longer with us, unfortunately, but his other band, Green Eggs and Ham, the I think it was the bass player or guitar player for that band, lived just down the outskirts of town and had like a farm almost. So he had like a full on punk rock show. Like NBC played it. Like it was like, it was fucked. Like it was like, it was absolutely insane. We were like 13, 14 at this point. This is, or I guess, was I 15 yet? I don't even think I was. And yeah, we're like going to see NBC play. There was like, the cops showed up, obviously, even though it was in like a field or like a farm, it was still close enough to town where people were like, what the fuck is there? There's hundreds of kids doing in cars and shit.
Yeah.
So yeah, it got shut down. But yeah, there was stuff like that kind of happening for the punk rock side of things. And then a year or two after that is kind of, they did amalgamate eventually. And then that's kind of when, you know, when this kind of like, I guess late 90s was when the screamo thing kind of really took off around here. And that kind of amalgamated punk rock and those alternative bands, which ended up kind of being more emo bands, and they kind of kind of came together. Yeah,
it's wild to think that Rainbow Butt Monkeys become Finger 11, because like,
yeah,
they're so huge internationally, and kind of like, you know, but to me it's always going to be Rainbow Butt Monkeys, because Rainbow Butt Monkeys had hits.
They did. They had like that first record, Letters from Chutney was the name of it. There was like three or four singles off of that were charting, and they had videos to go along with them, and they were all over Much Music. And they played City Hall. The Burlington City Hall had them play a free show outside on the City Hall grounds, closed down Brant Street, which is the main drag here. And probably like 5,000 people showed up. Like it was like fucking nuts. I don't think they expected that. There was thousands of people coming to see Rainbow Butt Monkeys. And it wasn't long after that success of that band where they were, I guess, their label, because they were on a major. They were on, I forget which major label it was, but their label was like, you guys may want to think about changing your name. And then they came up with Finger 11, which is clearly a penis, but I don't know.
Is that what? Oh my God, that is a watershed moment for me, because I had no idea. That's what.
I don't know if that's what it is, but that's what I've always thought it was.
I think you're right, because like, what else would be the 11th finger? I guess the nose. Maybe it's the nose,
right? I still see those guys around here once in a while. I still talk to their old drummer, Rich. I'll ask him.
Because I remember they were thanked in the Trunk CD, which to me blew my mind, because I did think it was kind of separate worlds. But I guess, you know, it's one of those things that the scenes grow and ebbs and flows. So it's sometimes when it contracts, everyone has to play together again. And then when it expands, everyone can kind of do their own thing.
Well, that's, yeah, you're totally right. And plus too, like venues started to shut down. And like I said, people's backyards were getting busted. So so there was only a certain point, there was only a few places everybody could play. So, and there's only Fridays and Saturdays really, you know? So yeah, everyone kind of had to play nice eventually.
So you mentioned Hood Rat off the top, and you wind up joining Hood Rat.
Yeah, I joined them when I was 15. Yeah.
So they were, by that point, they already had the 7-inch out, I think, right? The first 7-inch?
Yes, they did. The Fuck Corporate Punks one.
Fuck Corporate Punks, exactly. Yeah. Classic.
Yeah.
Toronto, or sorry, Southern Ontario record, but a classic for Toronto record stores. I remember seeing it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they were a band that was like doing it DIY, like legit, like the whole way through. Like I remember seeing, like they did zines too, and there was like,
yeah, the zine, our zine was called Punk Fiction.
That's it. I think I have a couple issues of Punk Fiction even.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was, and the label too was all DIY as well.
Yeah, everything. Meeting those guys, I looked up to them because they were a few years older than me. Corey and Giselle, what's her name? Those two were a few years older than me, so I kind of looked up to them because they were kind of like, for like the hardcore kind of punk part of the scene around Burlington, they were kind of the elder statesmen, so to speak. So I kind of really had, you know, they taught me a lot even before meeting them and them asking me to be in the band. I looked up to them and noticed that they would just go to Value Village, buy a shitload of shirts, screen them themselves. It did help that Corey was a very talented artist and would draw everything. He's actually a world-renowned tattooist now, so he's a very talented fella.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it helped. So he would do all the designs, and then we would like, yeah, we, when I finally joined them, we would, yeah, go to Value Village, buy just random shitty shirts and screen them and sell them at our shows. And everything was DIY. Like the Punk Fiction magazines were just regular letter paper and just photocopied and then folded over and stapled. That was,
yeah,
it.
It's a half size.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, you know, but they were fucking rad. It was super rad. And there was also, they were big proponents of the anti-racist action movement at the time, because there were a few, like, you know, racist white supremacy skinheads in and around our area, and not for long. Like, there was like a pretty rapid movement against that, and anytime one of those kind of little white supremacist pockets would pop up in like the Halton region, they would be all over it and they'd be gone. Like, it would be like, it was pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. I remember watching, you know, and going to shows and watching Much Music, and Corey was one of the first people I would recognize in the punk scene. Like, I saw him at Lollapalooza, and then I saw him on Much Music, like, would cover an event and he'd be in the background, 'cause his hair was so recognizable at that point. And then seeing Hood Rat, I was like, oh wow. Like, it was like local celebrity status.
Yeah, totally, man. He had the most badass mohawk. He'd have this huge spike, Liberty spike mohawk. And then he'd have like another one on the side came out this way.
Yeah.
Fucking badass, man. It was really awesome.
Was there like a big scene of that sort of like true kind of like punk in Burlington as well, like that stuff?
There was like Hood Rat would have played that MDC show at my buddy's farm. And once I joined Hood Rat, we did a lot. We played with, that's when I kind of started touring around a bit and kind of really noticed, like, experiencing what it's like to be in a real band. We did some shows with Blank 77. We did like a mini tour around Southern Ontario and shit. Who else did we play? We played with the Spasms, and like, I would take the GO train on Tuesday nights or Wednesday nights and with my gear and meet them downtown, 'cause they'd already be downtown Toronto. And we play like this like dive bar, but I wasn't old enough. So I had to stay with my gear in the fucking kitchen until we played. And then I'd play the show and then go back into the kitchen. They'd bring me like a fucking soda. And then I'd get my gear back together and scramble to make the last train home to go to high school the next day. And I rarely made it back to school, because not because I couldn't, just because I really didn't want to.
Yeah. Was that the Greeks in Kensington Market?
I'm
trying to think where you guys would have been playing then. 'Cause there's like,
we would have played, let me think. There was Who's Emma.
Who's Emma. Definitely. Yeah.
Was the Basement. We played the Basement of Who's Emma. The Cathedral would have been one that we would have played. The one specifically that wouldn't let me in was, it's still there. It's right on Queen Street, maybe Queen and Augusta. No, not, is that it? No, it's down from the Rivoli a bit. I'll 360 have to think of it.
Cameron House.
Maybe the Cameron House.
Okay. Yeah. That makes
I sense. Think it was the Cameron House. Yeah.
Did you ever play Spiderland Acres?
I don't think so.
That was that crazy punk fest just outside of the city limits, where it was like an old punk dude ran it. And there's stories of that thing, which just seem.
Oh, what's his name? What was his name? Was it Amance?
No. Amance is the legend. No, Amance is.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this guy was decidedly more a dirty punk than Amance was.
Okay. Gotcha. Right. Yeah. Amance was a very, very nice fellow. Very clean cut individual. Yeah.
That's amazing. Was he like a Hood Rat guy?
Yeah. Like, oh yeah. We used to hang out with him a lot.
That's awesome.
It's hard to remember a lot about him, 'cause I was, you know, a child, but yeah, he was around for sure. We used to hang out with him frequently. Yeah.
He rules. Well, rest in peace. He passed away years ago, but he like in the Bomp book of Bomp fanzine, there's a classified ad from him looking for Kinks bootlegs. And then in the Touch and Go book of all the Touch and Go fanzine, there's a classified ad of him looking for recordings of all these like international hardcore bands that were kind of coming out of the time. And we are, you know, and here we are years later, and he's still hanging out with Hood Rat. He was like the first guy to buy the Fucked Up demo when we put out a demo. Like, he was just always that awesome dude for bands, where he was always supportive and just loved music.
Yeah. Like, he was super, just a sweet guy too, because he was obviously old. Well, everybody was older than me then, but like, he was quite a bit older than me. Mm-hmm. And just to be around him and chat music with him. And it was rad, man. I don't have a bad thing to say about that, man.
Did you guys, with Hood Rat, did you tour into the US at all?
We never did. No, we did. Let me think here. We never made it across the border. We did a lot of Southern Ontario stuff. We did, a lot of Toronto stuff. I'm trying to remember if we went to Quebec or not.
If you didn't, recall. That is a huge missed opportunity. You would have gone over.
I know. Well, I was, the shitty part was that I was still in high school, right? Yeah. So I could only take so much time off. And then there was a point too where the band was, we were three piece and I was drumming, obviously. Then Corey played bass and sang, and Giselle played guitar and sang. But we were starting to wanting to get a little bit more technical with the music. Corey was a phenomenal bass player and Giselle was a phenomenal singer, but she wasn't the strongest at playing guitar at the time. So I ended up, at the time I was listening to a shitload of Propaganda, and I actually started playing guitar before drums. So I was way into guitar at that point. I was like, what do you think about me switching to guitar? I've got a pal of mine who's a sick drummer. He'll be able to like play what I play, no problem. And we'll just be a four piece. Giselle can play guitar as well, or she can just sing or whatever. And they're like, yeah, let's fucking do that. So then we ended up recording an EP with that and doing a split with
the Chinkies.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
That's Mike Park's band too. The guy who started Asian Man Records and
Skank and Pickle. Yeah. Fuck yeah. So we ended up doing that split. Yeah. So that's me on guitar playing on that split. And then my buddy, an old pal of mine, Dan, who's, I think he's a tattooist now too. He played drums on that record.
I got to hear that split because I would love to hear, like, the only configuration I knew was from the Consumerist split 12 inch.
Yes. So that was, So that was the original lineup with me playing drums and Corey and Giselle playing bass. We recorded that at Ruminal Records in Mississauga.
Yes.
Reel to reel. Mm-hmm. And every time the reel to reel would stop or he'd rewind it, there was some sort of classical music that had already been recorded on it. So he was just recording directly over that, which I thought was funny. Ruminal Records in Mississauga, that would have been 1995 or six, I guess.
They would also just do the tape for you too, right? They were also a tape manufacturing service.
Yes, they were. Yeah, he had the tapes, like racks of tape, recording machines, and he would just rake from the reel to reel straight to there, and then you'd walk out with your tapes. Yeah,
doing a DIY record at that point was a lot harder obviously now too, like to actually do it on vinyl. Like, no one did vinyl in Southern Ontario.
I don't remember who pressed it for us. I really don't remember. I have no recollection if we did that. Yeah, I remember the artwork vividly. I remember the process of doing a split with Consumerist because they were pals of ours that were from Kingston. We used to swap shows and tour around and stuff. But I have no idea who pressed that record.
There was a pressing plant back then in, Southern Ontario. I'm trying to remember what it was called. There was like, I guess, a local pressing thing, but it just felt like that was like the real low point for vinyl, right? Like, now that's why 90s records are so collectible.
Yeah. There wasn't a whole lot of vinyl. There was, I mean, I was collecting vinyl off my parents, which I still have. And, there was like Looney Tunes here in Burlington that you'd be able to get some really overpriced vinyl at, because it was rare. But there wasn't a ton going around. It was mostly tapes and CDs, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that stuff that you did with the split with Chinkies, is that like kind of like a different direction the band was going into that point?
Yeah, the band, it was. We had been, I guess, how long had I been in the band at that point? A couple of years anyway. And we were starting to get a lot of shows, like more college-esque kind of shows. This was kind of like the coalesce when the kind of scene started to merge too, that I noticed. Hardcore was kind of coming in and hardcore punk was kind of on the way out. And I could see that. And I was kind of, not only could I see it, I was into it. I loved it. I was really into 7 Seconds and Minor Threat and shit at that point. So I was right up my alley. And then obviously Propaganda and stuff. So we kind of shifted in that direction. And then by that point, the Giselle and Corey were having trouble with it seemed like they were maybe having a bit of trouble personally, because they were, they lived together and stuff. I don't know if they were ever like for sure a couple, but they had tried it and it didn't work, and there was some animosity and some problems within the band itself. So after that, that split kind of came out. We did a bunch of shows in and around Southern Ontario, and then it just kind of fizzled off, and I moved on to a band with my buddy that was in No Connection, who was on Raw Energy. We started another like back to like a ska punk slash hardcore band, which was fucking weird, but that band was called Chapter One.
Can you guys record or anything?
Oh yeah, we recorded. There's a whole box of CDs in my mom's basement somewhere.
I gotta get Chapter One CD next time you go to your mom's house. Let me know. I'll buy one off the merch table.
Yeah, it was called what did we call that record? The Fields of Eternal Eyes. You can tell we were getting a little bit stonery by that point. That was I was full stoner by that
point. Well, it's interesting because eventually, you know, Finger 11 becomes huge, but I imagine they're not like as much a part of the scene. But after that, Grade's kind of the biggest band from Burlington, you know, to kind of come out, and they kind of start blowing up around, you know, the early 2000s, late 90s, you know, it really starts taking off.
They did. It was interesting because I was a huge Grade fan, and I liked Jersey. Like, I was into Jersey because I was like, the band that I was kind of in was also a ska punk band, and Jersey was a very ska punk band. But Jersey and Grade were sharing like the majority of the members. Mm. So they were pretty much the same fucking band other than a couple people. So one by one, for whatever reason, people from Grade would leave Grade and then go with Jersey full time, beginning with Greg Taylor, who's a pal of mine still. And Kevin, their drummer, his last name escapes me right now, but Kevin, he ended up leaving Grade and going to Jersey full time.
And then Scooter came into Grade. I think
of Kevin Finlayson, another Kevin Finlayson, Scooter, who was a huge drumming inspiration for me right around that time. Big one.
I ended up working with him years later at a video store. And
oh, is that right?
Would just punish him for like Grade stories and stuff like that. And he's like, dude, why do you care about any of this?
Right? He doesn't get it. Like, I remember I never talked to him, but I remember asking some of the guys in Grade about him. And they're like, yeah, he fucking did that in one take. He was working. Yeah. He had a full-time job downtown Toronto, and he came in to record that wherever they were recording at the time. Signal to Noise, it probably was. And he came in on his lunch break, recorded that whole fucking 10 inch, and then just went back to work. Like, how, what?
It's crazy too, like to look back at that time, like, you know, and once again, it's like the economy of scales, like the Raw Energy thing, but I remember Jersey and Grade both had so much hype, but it felt like from two completely separate punk worlds at the time. Like, I remember going to see Jersey open for NOFX, and at the same time, Grade's about to get signed to Revelation or something. And it felt like, wow, those are like the apexes. And, you know, I imagine for Grade, that must have been kind of like a weird juggling act to try and be in both at the same time.
I think it was. Yeah, it was a weird juggling act. I've never talked to Greg on why he decided to pick Jersey over Grade, but it'd be interesting to find out.
Mm.
For whatever, like, I think the majority of it was Greg's, Greg was really inspired by kind of like Bruce Springsteen, and his biggest inspiration was probably Bruce Springsteen. I don't think I'm talking out of school by saying that. But also Rancid was a huge thing at that time as well. And I think the, you know, for whatever reason, he felt that the hardcore kind of screamo thing was just not something he was super passionate about that anymore. So Jersey was kind of his baby. Like, they kind of, you know, it was his thing to write songs that he wanted to write outside of what Grade was doing.
So one of the best demos I've ever heard. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's all right. Yeah. So that was pretty much the end of it. Anyway, so that's kind of, I think, why he did what he did and decided to do Jersey full time, which is, you know, it had its place. And we did, when I ended up joining Jersey, it was a wild ride, man. It was, you know, I went from like, I was 18, I think, when I joined Jersey, and we signed to a major label within like 6 months of that. I was like, fuck me. This is crazy.
Yeah.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I remember talking to Greg, I think it was at the NoFX show or maybe leading up to the NoFX show.
Was that the one that High Standard opened up?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, they had sushi nice. Backstage and everything.
That's
and,
so sick. Yeah.
And, he was saying how he, there. Yeah, that was an amazing show.
That was a sick show. I didn't play it actually. I wasn't in the band yet. I was just hanging out. I would have been in Hood Rat at that point.
Yeah, I think it was like they brought a bunch of people backstage and it was like a super, it was like a really just amazing time. Have you been to Japan and everything? Have you noticed how huge High Standard is in Japan?
I had never noticed, but I can imagine because fuck, they were kick ass.
they're like the big punk band. They're like the Blink 182 of Japan.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. They have their own festival that they headline and stuff like that. Like I picked up a bunch of High Standard records when I was over there.
Oh, that's so cool. I love it there. I really do love it there. I've gotten to go there. I've been lucky enough to go there with Alexis and Billy Talent. It's such a beautiful country. I love it. Oh,
I've same. Going back to like when, did you play an Outspan actually?
I never played an Outspan. No. I may have filled in for them once though. I don't think I ever was in the band. Well, I know I was never in the band, but I might have filled in. I filled in for so many bands. I was like the go-to guy. I still am. So I was like, hey, so-and-so is busy doing this. Can you learn these songs? Like, yeah, okay, sure. And it was easy because, like, you know, it's hall shows or club shows. There's usually only play for 45 minutes. So it's not rocket science. It's not like, you know, learning Tom Sawyer and
It's John Worster, who drums at Superchunk and plays drums in Mountain Goats and everything. He was on the show recently and he was talking about how he notices as a drummer, how every songwriter that he works with has like an internal, metronome that they're writing to, even no matter how fast and slow the song's going and how like he can tell who's written that song. And it must be fascinating going from all these different bands from such a young age too. And just like, you know, having to adapt to different songwriters' internal metronomes or lack of a metronome in some cases.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was always, that's always a thing. Still is. Everybody's got, and the problem I always had too, is like the BPM, like the beats per minute, if you're playing to a click or not, the BPM of a song that someone's written in there, you know, if you're in the rehearsal space, is going to change drastically on stage when the adrenaline gets pumping. Right.
Yeah.
So then, you have to know, this is why I ended up starting to play to click later on in my career, just because it's definitive. It's like, you don't get the look backs like you're playing too fast or too slow. It's like, well, it's the machine dictating the tempo. So I can bump it up, but it's not me.
Yeah.
But I used to run into that a lot where like, yeah, you'd play in rehearsal, you'd play the song at the, you know, they'd be like, okay, it's faster, slower. No problem. I got you. And then all of a sudden live, it would like jump, like, and I wouldn't really realize it because I'm playing the same tempo that I thought they wanted it at during rehearsals. But then when you go into the live setting, it's like, you get the look back. It's like, oh, motherfucker, you gotta speed up or slow down or whatever. So then it would, yeah. So it's always interesting to the difference between rehearsal and then that adrenaline rush that just boosts the song into like another dimension of speed.
Oh yeah, like, and that's, you know, when you listen to those Ramones live records, it's only recently that I found that was actually more by design, but I always just think they were just getting so excited, that's why they were playing them too fast when they were doing it live. But then it turns out, no, Johnny wanted to fuck with Joey, and Joey
is that hated right
playing that fast. Yeah, like apparently it really like really upset Joey how fast they were playing on stage because he couldn't fit the words in, which
you've
sung in band, like that's like that is the hardest part, is like trying to get your words to fit into the music, and when it's too fast, like, oh yeah, I wish we played with a click. What if I was just that next fucked up meeting, we didn't have this click.
Yeah, here. Right. It's got its place. Like a lot of the, like, for instance, like the older Billy Talent and Alexis stuff, I never played the click because it had its ebbs and flows, and that was part of the appeal of the music, right? So I just learned the tempos and learned the vibe of the guys and kind of where they wanted it. But the newer stuff, I love playing to click because we'll still bump it up a few for live purposes, but it's it gives it. See, the cool thing about it is I can back off the click or go ahead of the click as needed, but then the guys are also comfortable because it's at a speed that they're comfortable playing it at, and their vocals are able to, you know, they're able to fit all those syllables in comfortably, and it's got a good vibe for them, but it's also great for the rest of the band, everyone playing instruments as well. So you can kind of, you know, I push it forward a little bit or I pull it back just to kind of give to what the song kind of needs at that point in time during it.
Yeah, I guess it gives, like, yeah, as you say, it allows you to kind of like control that adrenaline hit that's coming. You know, you don't have to worry about riding it because it has its time and place.
I don't use it for it. Like, I think there's only like a handful of Alexis songs where we actually, anything new, like anything Crisis or newer, we would use it. But anything prior to that, you don't need to.
So when you joined Jersey, that's when your first time touring internationally, I guess.
That would have been the first time to the U.S. Yeah. Yeah, that was a mind trip. I would have been 18 when we started going down south. Yeah.
What were those tours like with Jersey at that point?
It was rad, man. They had just been sponsored by West 49. Funny enough, the bass player from Trunk, Jerry, was a higher up at West 49 by that point. And so they were able to sponsor us, and they gave us a lot of free clothes, and they bought us a trailer for us to put all our gear in to go down there and just put a big West 49 sticker on the back, which is kind of funny to think about. So yeah, we started cooking down to the states. The very first thing I did with them down south was we were getting looked at by David Basin, who's a records guy. I think he ended up working for it. Was he on Roadrunner at the time? He was like an A&R guy that was pursuing us. So we did a couple of showcase shows down there. We did one at CBGB's, which was a fucking trip. And then we did another one. Oh, man, I forget the name of the other venue, but it's also a pretty renowned venue.
Was it Max's or something?
It was in Manhattan. It was in Manhattan still, but I'm just trying to think of what the name of the venue was.
Knitting Factory. I can't
think of it. It wasn't the Knitting Factory.
Mercury Lounge?
Yes. Thank you. That's one. Yeah. You're good. You. Yeah, that was it. So yeah, we did CBGBs and the Mercury Lounge and played for all these record execs and, you know, major label people and shit. And then, that was the first time experiencing the States. And that was, that would have been 2002. That would have been sometime in 2002. So it was, shortly after the Twin Towers, actually. I remember going to Ground Zero right after in the middle of doing all these shows and just like seeing the reality of that. that was a hard hit for an 18-year-old kid. I'll tell you, it was pretty wild. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was just I'll never forget that entire experience, going to the States for the first time, doing something that you never thought you'd be able to do, drumming for a living and going down there, and didn't make any money, but who gave a fuck, you know? We were down there doing what we love to do and seeing the world and traveling and getting to play CBGBs and, like, you know, just that it was pretty crazy, man. It's a crazy time.
Well, so it's also a pre Alexis on Fire, Billy Talent world where
there's no
one who's kind of like carved out a path to like success out of this thing, you know, like it's just like, what do you like, you know, you're making your own roadmap at this point. Like now, you know, post, you know, the success that both of your bands have had, like it's, there's a lot more, you know, ceiling for doing this kind of thing in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Yeah. At the time we were just happy to, get our five, I think we had like a $5 a day per diem or something. which was enough for a pack of smokes and a bag of chips. That's about it.
Or a Taco Bell combo.
Oh yeah. That was a big one. We used to definitely eat a lot of Taco Bell.
So how did the signing to a major label thing happen?
So we did those showcase shows down in New York, and there was two people that were really interested in us. Tracy McNamara, who was working for EMI up here in Canada, and then David Basin, who was a Canadian guy but working down in Manhattan. I want to say it was for Roadrunner, but I can't remember. He might have been a subsidiary. I can't recall exactly who it was. So they were fighting for us for Jersey. They really wanted us to succeed. And they introduced us to what was the name of that management company? It was Rob Lanny, Rob Lanny's management company up here in Toronto. The name of the company escapes me right now. But so that we had like a good strong team of people that really loved the band. And then you throw in Mr. George Strombolopoulos on top of that, who was a huge fan of Jersey as well. And he was a proponent for us, and he was really trying hard to spin us on much music and stuff. And
wearing your shirts too.
Yeah, right. So we had a lot of people that really loved us, and it didn't, you know, it was we were very lucky and very fortunate, and we knew that. So we wanted to fight and try to get our, you know, bust into the scene, into that. We just wanted people to hear our music, basically, because we had some success in and around Southern Ontario and had done some stuff across Canada. The guys, Jersey guys, just before I joined, had just done a run of shows in the States that did okay. So we wanted to just get out there and do as much stuff as we could. And these, you know, those people really helped us out. And then, so when we signed to EMI, they didn't really know what, because EMI at that point was like a conglomerate. There was like all these different labels underneath the EMI umbrella. It's funny that EMI doesn't even exist anymore, but so it was like EMI Virgin Capital, I think, in Canada, and they didn't know where we fit because we were such a unique kind of punk rock band that didn't really fit the mold. Like they tried to introduce us to songwriting producers and stuff, and we were like, no fucking way are we doing that. In hindsight, it wouldn't have been terrible, but at the time we were like, no thanks. We signed, ended up getting the Virgin moniker was the one that they picked. Virgin Music Canada was the moniker that they chose for us to be on. So that was it was a pretty cool experience, because at the time major labels were still a thing for rock bands. They still had money and the people were still buying records. So they, they kind of spoiled us. I remember they bought me a nice Canada Goose jacket that I still have. I still wear it snowmobiling when it's like minus 20.
Some good swag.
They treated us really nicely. And that was weird for us, because we all kind of grew up on the other side of the tracks, like, you know, pretty modest upbringing. So it was, it was an interesting time. But then we kind of saw the writing on the wall when we wouldn't budge, and they were kind of like, well, we give you money, so you need to budge. And we're like, sorry, I guess this, you know, we did the major label record thing, and then kept trying to keep the train on the tracks. And eventually you get to a point, like those guys are a few years older than me too, so you get to a point where life gets in the way and you've got to choose, you know, are you gonna keep slugging this out, or are you gonna, you know, what are you gonna do? So it was an eye-opening experience and an interesting one to be on a major at that point, but yeah, I don't know. It has its pros and cons for sure. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Was there any overlap between you doing stuff with Alexis, or did the two bands play together even?
Yeah. So that's kind of how I met those boys. Jersey got offered to do later in our career. We got offered to do shows with Alexis out East. I think it was an East Coast run. And there was some Quebec shows in there as well. And I'm trying to think who was all on the bill. It was Jersey, Alexis, I believe it was At the Mercy of Inspiration, and
Pre-Cancer Bats.
Maybe the Cancer Bats, yeah.
Oh, At the Mercy was Pre-Cancer Bats, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. No, yeah, it wouldn't be Cancer Bats. I did do an East Coast tour with the Cancer Bats when I was in Alexis, but later. So I don't think they were that. So that's how I met those guys. And we immediately fell in love. They were, you know, great dudes. Same, you know, same very strong working ethic that we had. So we ended up kind of falling in love, like a full on bromance on that tour. And then that summer or the summer after, we ended up splitting our very first tour bus on Warp Tour. We were both sick of doing Warp Tour in a van because it's terrible. So we decided to put our bunts together, our shekels, and we ended up splitting a bus, our very first bus. It was a 1980s Eagle, and we mainly bought it because Warp Tour is a nightmare, and you just can't get away from the heat in a lot of the cities because you're just on a tarmac in a parking lot, and there's just no way to escape the heat. So if you have a bus, at least you can go in there and cool down a little bit and get some sleep, and you don't have to drive yourself, which is nice.
Wait, you guys bought a bus?
No, we just split renting one.
Oh, split rent one. I thought you bought one. I'm like, who's driving this thing?
No, because they're expensive. Buses are really expensive. And we were super excited. The bus picked them up at the Penn Center in St. Catharines. And then they met us here in Burlington at the Burlington Mall. And we all got on the bus. And the first stop was Quebec City. And everything was great. And then we came to realize that the fucking air conditioner didn't even work. So it was even hotter than a van would have been. So we were just, it was a sweat box. It was nuts. And then at night, there would be some solace. That's when the air conditioning actually would work and you would get at least be able to sleep for a little while.
Yeah.
But yeah, during the day, it was a nightmare. It was just a great bonding experience. I think that being our first bus and doing Warped Tour together on it and living together for, I think we did it for like almost a month, I would have been around. That was a wonderful bonding experience for the Jersey guys and the Alexis guys. And then shortly thereafter, when Alexis was looking for someone to fill in for a little while, Jersey had just broken up, and McNabb from Jersey and Outspan and the Creep Show, he was tour managing Alexis because they needed someone to tour manage him, and they were on the East Coast. And they were like, well, we need a drummer right quick. Who can we get? And McNabb's like, why don't you get Beardo? Like, Rapbeard will do it. It's like, well, can he do that? He's like a ska punk guy. Like, no, he's not. He's just, he just plays everything. He can, I'm sure he could figure it out. So then they called me and Wade called me actually. And asked if I could do the shows and go on tour with them for like, there was a month, through the States, down to the Southern States, and then across Canada with Rise Against, and then a couple days home, and then another month over in Europe. With Rise Against, and then Rise Against would be splitting a bus with Alexis over there. And I was like, yeah, I can fucking do that. Yeah, sure. That sounds good. Let's do it. So I learned like, I don't know, I think like 12 of their songs or something in like 2 or 3 days as they were driving home from Moncton. And then we met up at Wade's mom's house in the basement and played together for, I think, 2 days maybe, and then hit the road and yada, yada, yada. Here we are today, 20 years later.
So had you done the Warped Tour in a van prior to getting into this bus?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, it sucks. Yeah. Jersey did it a couple of times. Not the full thing because you couldn't. There were bands that did the full thing in a van.
Yeah.
But like I said, the guys in Jersey were a couple of years older than me. So they were like, you know, they'd already done the van thing for a few years before I came along. And they were like, no fucking way are we doing it longer than a couple of weeks. So we would get offered like a chunk of it, maybe like a couple weeks of it. And we would do that and then head home, because it's too much. It's too much to do in a van. And plus there's no money in it really. Like you're literally living off of $5 to $10 a day and you're not getting paid really. It maybe you'll get some money from merch to keep the fuel tank full, but, you come home at a loss generally. We would anyway.
Yeah, like a lot of bands, well, I guess they would sign major labels later on. Like that would be like, you know, tour support that the label would pay for to try and get the band hype, because it was, you know, it was a great way to get exposed as a band to a bunch of kids at once.
Yeah, yeah. It was the shows were super fun for the most part. But then again, some of the shows and some of the weird Warped Tour cities that they'd go to weren't so fun. You know, you're playing like the worst stage to nobody at 11:30 in the morning. And you're like, oh my God, this is terrible, but it's all part of the experience.
What about the year a few years later? And I've talked to Wade about this too, where there was almost that divide where the old punk bands hated the new punk bands. And there was like the Warped Tour Civil War almost. It
was there? Like, do you know who between whom? I don't know if I remember
the
that.
It was the year that Under Oath was on and NoFX was on.
Oh yeah.
Jake. And there was like beef between bands, and bands would talk shit on each other on stages. And Wade was saying certain people wouldn't let you go into their barbecue because, you know, you weren't part of that clique or something.
Funny thing about that, one of the barbecues, I remember that year, Billy Talent was on that year, and so was Alexis. And was I with Alexis or was I with Jersey? I can't remember right now. I would have been with Jersey then. So it was Jersey, Alexis splitting a bus, and then Billy Talent was also on. And there was like, yeah, one of those like elder statesman barbecues. And Ian and I and Jesse, the old drummer from Alexis, were in there hanging out with some of the older guys. And for whatever reason, Ian and Jesse were hugging or something and they tripped. And I forget which band it was. Maybe one of the other guys would know. It was like Bouncing Souls, or it might have been like NoFX. It was one of the older punk bands. They had been like preparing these steaks all day because there's so few things to look forward to on Warped Tour. These guys were probably so stoked to have these steaks, and they were on the grill on like a charcoal grill. And for whatever, Ian and Jesse like got entangled and then tripped and then fell onto the grill. The steaks went flying, launched, no. Landed right on the ground, completely inedible, and then we got kicked immediately out. So maybe that was why the beef started in the first place. I don't know, but that would make sense.
Beef over beef.
Right? Yeah. That was terrible. I felt so bad for those guys. But and also like Jesse and Ian, I think they got minor burns from that. Like they fell right on the grill.
Oh my God. Well, yeah. Charcoal barbecue too. That's like not a fun thing to land on it under the best of circumstances, let alone in a hostile post Warped Tour elder statesman barbecue.
No,
sure, no one's handing out Band-Aids or aloe vera or any creams to help you at that point.
No, it was an immediate get the fuck out of here. And then, and then I don't think we really talked to them ever again.
Well, I've had a blast talking to you, Jordan.
Me too, man. We got to do this again. This was super fun, man. I had a blast. It's great to fucking think about all that stuff from back in the day. I never really think about it anymore. It's a lot of fun.
Well, you've got like this amazing, you know, like, and I think it's, you know, yourself included in this, but like you think about that scene and how small these shows were, and yet you have yourself, Finger 11, Fall Off the Earth, like all this stuff coming out of this, like, you know, this, and Grade. Of course, yeah. Jersey, you know, like there's just like it's a fascinating time and place. So thank you for taking me through it and help me connect some of these dots.
Anytime, my friend. Anytime. It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jordan, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Jordan will be back at some point for a part two. And we will, there's a lot more to discuss because we really didn't get to the part of his career where he started really, really touring the world with Alexis on Fire and Billy Talent. Check out Otherness wherever you pick up your records. Check out Jordan on tour with Billy Talent and Alexis on Fire playing probably a large venue near you some point soon. Huge thank you again to Cream Magazine for coming on board and helping this podcast out. Check out cream.com. Grab a subscription to this thing and flip through it. Flip through an issue. I really do think if you're a fan of the glory days of music magazines, they are back and you can check it out there. And then you can check out the archive because there's tons. Oh my gosh. I'll be talking about that more in the next few weeks, I promise you. Speaking of things coming soon, coming up on the next episode of Turned Out a Punk, Wade McNeil will be here from Alexis on Fire for a part two. This is once again part of this Otherness week that I'm doing, Alexis on Fire week around here. I'm excited for you to hear it. Check out Wade's first appearance on the show way back when, and we catch up and have a fun little short conversation, and you'll hear it coming up here on the show very soon. All right, that's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and races and nationalities, and just stop all this sort of hatred and violence, because this isn't political stuff that we're talking about when we're talking about racism and homophobia and transphobia and violent misogyny. We're talking about basic human rights. People deserve to not have to worry about this stuff and to live free from these sorts of things. So get involved. If there's organizations that are doing positive work in this world that you believe in, you stand behind, or you want to see make headway, get involved. Donate time, money, if you have it, whatever you can. Be the change you want to see. You know, that's what I try and tell myself too, all the time. I'm speaking of things that I would also like to add to this list, we got to make sure that people are able to do what they want with their reproductive systems and are free from laws that impose things upon them and take away those rights and restrict those rights. Heavy stuff. Speaking of getting involved, though, start a band, start a fanzine. Punk rock, it gets better with your participation. So do something, you know. Maybe just draw a picture for yourself. Maybe draw a flyer. Flyers are cool. Flyer art is really cool. And you don't see it as much of it anymore. Maybe you do. Maybe I'm just oblivious to it now. But, you know, draw a flyer. So speaking of doing things, sign your organ donor cards. Because by the time they come looking for your organs, you don't need them because you're dead. Your brain dead at that point. So they just take your organs and hopefully someone else can get life from them. So sign those cards, please. I've seen it do miracles. I've seen people come back to life after that shit. Not after they were brain dead and their organs were taken. I mean, like the people with organs came back. And it sounds like I'm being an asshole and fucking around, but I swear to God, I've seen it happen. Try meditating, because I didn't believe in it. And I know people have done it for thousands and thousands of years. People have realized that centering yourself and focusing on your breath and quieting your mind is beneficial. But I don't know. I didn't believe in it. And now I do. So try meditation. And I think that's it for me. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.